Welcome to the Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Medicine Podcast. Episode 18. Myocardial screening for type 2 diabetes. The DIAD trial. This episode of the podcast features an interview with Dr. Franz Wackers from Yale, quite a famous doctor who's done really lots of work for many decades in nuclear medicine. And he's going to talk to us about the DIAD trial and its use of myocardial perfusion imaging screening in asymptomatic type 2 diabetics. And I'm sure you'll find that a most interesting podcast. But before we get to that, some news for our podcast. For those interested in getting CPD points for listening to the podcast, and I know there's many of you out there that do, technologists, physicians, physicists, chemists, and many of your associations that assert the granting of podcast points do give points for answering online quizzes. I know the Australian New Zealand Society of Nuclear Medicine does. We'd like to start doing that with our podcast. So we're after some beta testers who can help us look at this as a test, and I've already put one test up, but I'm also interested in people who are happy to write tests. So if you're interested in getting involved with this beta test program of quite quick 10-question multiple-choice quizzes, then email me at rob@newcast.com and I'll be able to send you a login code, and that means you'll log into a website which has been created with the quizzes. Now, I'm not going to use the email addresses or all those details for any marketing purposes, and at the moment, certainly for a while yet, it's really a free program. So all those interested in getting involved in the beta test program, please email me at rob@newcast.com and I'll send you a login code and a site that you can log in and start doing the quizzes immediately and start getting some points for your CPD program. I'm sure you'd be interested in that. I've also updated the links. You can get the podcast details page at nukecast.com. That's nuccast.com. And or www.newcast.com, and you can, if you're using iTunes or Juice or any other RSS or podcast software, and that's really the best way to get the podcast, then that feed you can put in is either Molcast, that's molcast.com, or www.molcast.com. If you go to that page, then it'll give you a simple explanation of how you can subscribe to that feed using your podcast software. The cardiac subset of the podcast is now at cardiac.newcast.com, and the feed, which you can subscribe to with your iTunes or other podcast software, is cardiac.molcast.com. That's cardiac.molcast.com. So I'm sure that makes it easier and simpler for you to do that. The cardiac component is just the same podcast, but excluding the non-cardiac ones. We do seem to have a lot of cardiac podcasts, but there'll be some non-cardiac ones as well coming up. I just been to the autumn meeting of the British Nuclear Medicine Society, and there's some great stuff there. We've managed to get some good interviews there, looking at the place of CT and how much CT you use. We've also got a hands-on interview, if you like, on site, looking at the new D-Spec camera, and I'm sure you'll find that very interesting. And so I'm sure those sorts of things you'll find very interesting in upcoming episodes. And of course, we've got some great episodes recorded at the ICNIC meeting. That's the International Nuclear Cardiac Meeting in Prague earlier this year, which was a great meeting, and we've got some great things coming up, some really interesting stuff. And of course, beginning with today's episode of the podcast, looking at diabetes, that's really the disease of the 21st century, and how myocardial perfusion works in managing that disease. And that's something I'm sure you'll be very interested in, and is really a very interesting topic. So without further ado, we'll go straight into that podcast now. Here I am speaking to you from Prague again, and I'm privileged to be speaking to Dr. Wackers from Yale, who I'm sure everybody is familiar with in the world of nuclear medicine, and has done a lot of work over many years, particularly in cardiac nuclear medicine. I'm just going to hand it over to him, and he can tell you a little bit about where he is at the moment and what he's doing.
Okay, Robert, so you asked about the DIA trial. So the DIA trial started in about 2000, when the interest in the association of diabetes and coronary artery disease really came up, and when people started realizing that having diabetes is a, of course, was realized as being a risk factor for coronary artery disease, but it became clear that having diabetes was almost like if you had your first myocardial infarction already. And at that time, the American Diabetes Association and the American Heart Association became really interested and made the research in patients with diabetes for cardiovascular disease a priority. Now, the issue is really once you have a patient that you recognize as having coronary artery disease, you're often very late in the game. They may have triple vessel disease, diffuse disease, and clearly you are sort of behind the events. And the problem is that many patients with diabetes actually do not have symptoms. So they don't come with you with typical angina symptoms, and often sudden death or myocardial infarction is the first symptom. So there was a great interest, well, how do we now detect these patients before they become clinically evident? And that was actually the start of the DIA trial. And the idea was really to look at patients with diabetes who were totally asymptomatic, who had absolutely no evidence of having coronary artery disease, and see, well, what is really the prevalence of silent ischemia. And that's important because if you have a high prevalence of silent ischemia, then it would be justified to do stress tests in any patient with diabetes. But and that's the problem with screening, that if you have too low a prevalence of the disease, you may get a lot of false positives. So it's to justify screening, you should actually be we're in the intermediate range. So if you have a prevalence of, let's say, 30%, 40%, then you have a reasonable yield of your test, and it would be justified to perform screening. So that's what we did in the DIA study, and we found actually that the prevalence of silent ischemia is about 22%, which is really on the low end. It might justify screening, but it's really not very high. It's, and in a way, that was very reassuring because people had thought before that patients with diabetes might have a 60% prevalence of silent coronary disease. So that's not the case. The first one was sort of good news, but the bad news is that indeed there is silent ischemia, and in some patients it's very severe. So at that time, we looked for ways to sort of find a profile of patients that in increased risk of having abnormal perfusion studies. And we had many, many clinical and biochemical parameters that we could look for. And to our disappointment, actually, we didn't find any, the diabetes control or C-reactive protein or PAI-1 or lipid spectrum, hypertension. All these things did not actually predispose patients for having a higher prevalence of silent myocardial ischemia. So that was sort of a sobering message. And the next question then was, well, what should you do? Should we indeed do screening in all patients with diabetes, or is there still something else that we can do? And actually, at that time, interesting enough, since you are from the UK, I learned about the work by Lahiri and Anand, and they did actually a very similar study. They looked at patients with diabetes who were asymptomatic, but they'd first do calcium screening by CT. And I think that's a perfect match of what we did. So they found very similar results, actually. And then what they found was that the prevalence of abnormal myocardial perfusion SPECT studies actually coincides with increasing prevalence of coronary calcium. And so this would be one way to enrich your population. So if you would do as a first test coronary artery calcium scanning, then those who are abnormal to do myocardial perfusion imaging, depending on the amount of calcium, you would have a yield that could be as high as 75%. So I think at the present time, it is important that we are aware that silent ischemia occurs in patients with diabetes. It's not as prevalent as we thought, but still it's important because some of these patients have very severe abnormalities. Now, what we're doing in the DIET study is still going on. Is we are following these patients for 5 years. Every patient will have at least 5 year follow-up, and that follow-up will be completed in September 2000, so in a couple of months. And at that time, we will first of all look at what is the cardiac event rate, so how severe are the cardiac events in these patients who are really totally asymptomatic. Is there a predictive value of the perfusion abnormalities that we see? And we also are looking at the present time at the progression of disease. And you would expect that patients with diabetes, once they have developed abnormalities, that they would actually get worse over time. And that's another aspect that we are looking at in the diabetes study. And I think you have to wait until September of 2007 or a little later when we do the data analysis, and we will tell you more about this.
Thank you. It was very interesting, particularly your reference to the London study. I've already spoken to the authors about that, in fact, on my podcast, and they, of course, referred to your study. I think it was interesting, in the London study, there's a very large South Asian population, Indians and Pakistani and so on, and I think perhaps the combination of diabetes and the South Asian population is a particularly dangerous one for cardiac disease. I mean, I suppose there's one other aspect to your trial I think that's quite interesting in that if we do image these patients, if we do screen them, is that going to affect their outcome? Do the patients that are screened and know about their possible cardiac disease earlier, are they going to achieve better outcome than those that don't? And along with that is, of course, the rise of medical management. I mean, wasn't that long, well, until very recently, everybody gets a stent. But I think the very recent studies have shown that medical management's important and may indeed help with these patients. What do you think about, you know, those factors?
I think that the DIET study will indeed give answers to that. First of all, it doesn't matter if you have abnormal images or not. And I mean, we're still blinded to the data, but some patients had cardiac events. And I know that a very high percentage of the patients who had cardiac events indeed had abnormal myocardial perfusion studies. There is indeed no data, at least in patients with diabetes, that if you take the patients who had abnormal studies and you treat them one way or another, whether they really get better. There's only one non-randomized study, more an observational study that I mentioned in my lecture this morning from the Mayo Clinic, where they looked at patients who had revascularization compared to patients who had medical therapy, and that in the overall group, there was actually no difference. Well, no difference actually is, to a certain extent, good news, because it meant that the medical treatment was very effective, equally effective as intervention. It was not like that the outcome was bad in these patients. And it was only actually in the patient with large abnormalities that bypass surgery, and not PCI, but bypass surgery, did improve the outcome compared to medical treatment. And so I think that, as I mentioned, so in the DIET study, we are following these patients. We know, of course, how they are being treated, although it's not a treatment trial. And we'll be able to make some conclusions about the predictive value of having silent myocardial ischemia, and also whether there is either progression or regression of silent myocardial ischemia, and if there is a effect by the medical treatments that these patients received. Because one important thing happened while the study was going on, That is, in 2001, the American Diabetes Association published guidelines where they very strongly recommended that patients with diabetes should be treated as having coronary artery disease, that they should be treated with statins, that their blood pressure should be controlled, they should have aspirin, and they should probably also be on an ACE inhibitor. And we had no control over that, but we know now that that happens within the DIET study. And we will be able to see, so it's an unintended effect of treatment while we were doing this study.
So I think one of the important roles of nuclear medicine is not merely in diagnosing heart disease, but in guiding management and in deciding what's the most appropriate therapy, and more importantly, how the intensity of the therapy should be. Do you think that's the case, particularly with type 2 diabetes, which people have said is the disease of the 21st century?
Yeah, I think the imaging techniques we're using are very well standardized. In our laboratory, we quantify all images, and the quantification we're using is incredibly reproducible. And I showed in my lecture one patient, where we followed the patient over a period of 7 years, and that particular patient had a very high-risk study in the beginning, so 9 years ago now, and he was treated in aggressively with statin and ACE inhibitor and later niacin as well, and his lipid spectrum improved. And actually his ischemia completely disappeared. He still had an infarct and he had a depressed ejection fraction, but he had for a period of 6-7 years absolutely no evidence of ischemia. Unfortunately, his patient had coronary artery disease and he had an infarct. He had a large scar and he actually died from sudden death, but not after having increasing ischemia. And even a very short period before he died, actually had an abnormal study, but no ischemia. And I think that is an example of how powerful the medical treatment is that we have at the present time. It does not cure disease, but it certainly seems to cure ischemia.
The other aspect, I suppose, in terms of the trial is what are the appropriate imaging techniques that are particularly applicable to diabetes. And there's been some discussion that echo has problems in diabetes and that anatomical imaging is not particularly good in diabetics because of the nature of the disease. Have you got any comments on that?
Yeah, I think that the first aspect is that patients with diabetes often are overweight. And so that creates an imaging problem with echo. They may have a poor window, but also they can often not exercise very well. And like in the DIET trial, we made, in retrospect, a wise decision that we would not do exercise testing, but would do pharmacological stress. So all patients had the same stress. And we said, well, okay, if they can do low level of exercise, and there's more to improve the quality of images, so if they can do low level of exercise, then they should do that. Now, it turned out that only half of the patients could do that. So it was very good that we had the stress modality standardized across the whole study. So it's the patients are unable to exercise, they are overweight. So I think that for most patients, imaging technique indeed is the way to go. And whether you should use echo or myocardial perfusion imaging, I think depends again on the experience and the all particular institutions. I think it's easier to see mild perfusion abnormalities than mild reads of wall motion abnormalities. And because that's another thing that I would like to emphasize, is that the patient who didn't have silent myocardial ischemia was not like a massive myocardial ischemia. They had definite but rather subtle abnormalities. And it was only of the 6% of all patients who had really markedly abnormal studies that would justify it without any further to go to cardiac catheterization. So that as a group, they have disease, but it's still, because they're asymptomatic, obviously, it's still rather subtle. And a well-standardized, quantifiable imaging technique, I think, would be preferred.
Yes, things like diastolic dysfunction and those sorts of things are important too, and they do sometimes create problems for echo as well, I guess.
Yeah, we never looked at that. Actually, we did look at diabetic cardiomyopathy, of course. All patients had not only pharmacological stress and myocardial perfusion imaging, but also gated imaging. So because we didn't know what we were going to find, but we knew that there is a substantial number of patients who have already a depressed ejection fraction, and presumably because of a diabetic cardiomyopathy. Well, the diet study, again, asymptomatic patient, I believe that occurred only in about 4 patients, so it was not very prominent. So that was systolic dysfunction. We did not look at diastolic dysfunction, so I cannot give you any comment on that.
Dyspnea, that's something that's come up recently too as a particular aspect as an early sign in cardiac disease and diabetics. Is that something that you found or related to in the trial?
Well, dyspnea is a very non-specific sign, of course, and I find that, although I don't deny that that is in some patients a symptom, I think you have many patients where they may have complaints and they may not be related to coronary artery disease, and particularly in this patient population who are, in general, there were many were obese and deconditioned. They may have neuropathy. They may not be able to walk so well. It's not a symptom, I think, that's particularly helpful. My bottom line is actually that if you have diabetes, if you're over 50, if you have diabetes for about 10 years, I think it's important that your physician starts looking whether you have mild myocardial ischemia. I think that would be totally justified.
Yes, and neuropathy, of course, is part of that process. Thank you again. I've taken probably more than enough of your time. I really appreciate you giving up your time, and more than that, I appreciate the work that you're doing for diabetic patients and for nuclear medicine.
You're most welcome.
I can't thank the contributors to the podcast and the people who prepared to be interviewed for the podcast enough, because that's what really makes the podcast successful. So thank you to Dr. Wackers for helping us out with that. And of course, if you know of anybody who has got some good projects or could contribute to the podcast through an interview or a debate, or if you've just got any suggestions at all in terms of the startup music, the audio, whether you'd like to have this as an AAC file, that's one with images in it, instead of an MP3 file, or anything about the podcast at all, please drop me a line. I'd love to hear from you. And, of course, I'd love to hear your feedback on the quizzes that we're starting to work through now and put into the podcast. So please drop me a line. Ask if you want to log in for the quizzes, and please let me know how you feel about the podcast and any ways that we can improve it, or any ways that perhaps you can help with content or maybe even writing quizzes. So I'd appreciate any help I can get along those lines. And so I'd love to hear from you next time. Hopefully it won't be too long and I'll get some more great interviews. They've got some really good material in the bag, but I can never have too much. So until next time, it's goodbye from the Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Medicine Podcast.